And the next orders from the Senate that come down to Pompey are orders for him to go to Africa and face
Domitius Ahenobarbus,
who had raised a considerable army from the Marian legions settled there. Anyway, with King Horabus, damn it, dude, these pronunciations, with King
Ahenobarbus. Ahenobarbus.
H-A-H-I-A-R-B-A-S?
Yeah, A-H-E-N-O-B-R-B-A-R.
Sorry, this is different. H-I-A-R-B-A-S.
I know that's not right. It's Ahenobarbus.
And it's someone else. Anyway, who had raised a considerable army from the Marian legions settled there, along with the king of Numidia. They sailed with 6 legions, 120 warships, and 800 transport. When Pompey landed in Utica and Carthage, 7,000 deserters immediately joined him. So Pompey had 40,000 plus men. When Pompey landed on the beaches and was ready to form up his ranks, a few of his men found some buried chest full of treasure.
When Pompey ends up landing here, some of his troops end up finding treasure, and it creates a frenzy, a gold rush, if you will, and he basically loses control of his men, and they go mad with the desire to find treasure, and they start digging massive holes, and he really can't do anything to really contain his men, so he just allows them to dig themselves out.
Treasure that was kind of ignorantly thought to have been buried by the ruined survivors of Carthage 65 years before. And I think it's honestly just, as opposed to helplessness, I think it's a testament to Pompey's generalship to know when to set back and let men get treasure hunting out of their system.
Exactly. And towards the end, instead of, you know, and I think this kind of goes against, you know, this idea that he was such a ruthless individual. You know, they say his troops tell him, you know, don't punish us. We've been punished enough. And he's lenient on them, and he just ends up commanding them. They follow him and ask him what their orders are.
So Pompey's army meets, Domitius's and King of Numidia's army, on relatively rough terrain. Pompey reportedly has twice the number of men, and this tactic of Pompey's, or this coincidence of Pompey's, to be at a numerical advantage seems to, again, just dissipate any credit he gets as a general. But we've already seen in previous engagements that Pompey was either unprepared or outgunned. Bad weather forced the enemy to retreat, and Pompey charged when visibility was poor. So this was a pretty daring and unexpected move of Pompey. Bad weather usually means no fighting. As in ancient times, the winter season was usually a camping time and wasn't generally the season for war. And this also has some religious implications, as basically everything does. But apparently Pompey is almost killed by one of his own men because he was slow to signal. An ancient battle, since these were all Romans fighting each other, a lot of times they would have a call signal. You know, Venus the Victoria, or, you know, Hercules the Invincible, Venus the Victorious, some kind of signal or gesture to let you know whose side you're on. Apparently Pompey was pretty slow to signal and almost loses his head. Pompey did win the day, but he refused to be hailed as imperator by his troops, as the enemy camp was still up. Pompey, from that moment on, Pompey also removed his helmet so that he wouldn't be confused again. It must have been pretty horrible to almost be cut down by your own men. Pompey storms the camp. Domitius dies, and Pompey accepts his title as Imperator, which is a title that can only be bequeathed by troops in the field. He still has to go after king of Numidia.
Right.
How do you say Hyabaris? King Hyabaris, forgive my pronunciation. Email us, lifeofpompey@gmail.com, and tell me how to pronounce it. He still has to go after King Hyabaris, who is already on the run from the son of Bocchus, Bacchus.
So basically, King Bacchus was the individual that turned over Jugurtha to Sulla. You know, really, if we look at the Jugurthine War, he could have easily turned over Sulla to Jugurtha. He was kind of a flaky, character that could have went either way. So we get a sense in Africa, you know, that a lot of these troops are more of the skirmishing, kind of wild tribes that are fighting in unorganized fashion, usually on horseback. So those are the kind of troops that...
Numidian cavalry were more famous for their horses.
Absolutely.
Okay, so long story short, Hyabaris flees to Bola Regia and is eventually executed. Pompey restores the kingdom of Numidia to King Hyempsal. Yes. Apparently he goes on a safari caging lions and elephants. Africa's an exotic place. I guess
Right. And I think he famously says that, you know, he even wants, the African wildlife to fear his, or to know that, the strength of Rome or something along those lines.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to the Roman supremacy. So, Sulla might be getting a little anxious here. So Sulla orders Pompey to send his legions home and to wait with one legion in Africa for replacements. And the troops that are serving with Pompey don't like this decree.
Supposedly. I mean, we see this with Strabo as well, where, Strabo is meant to turn over his troops to his cousin Pompeius Rufus. And Strabo kind of backs off, and then his troops kind of act on his behalf and murder Pompeius Rufus. We're told that, Pompey addresses his troops, and his troops, won't follow his orders to disband. We're told that Pompey is crying, and he walks off stage, and his troops, drag him back to the area where he's speaking.
They want Pompey to pull Hasola. They want Pompey to come to Rome with them.
Right, and I think that was probably one of Sulla's biggest fears at this point.
Well, I think he was pretty, at this point in Pompey's career, is a pretty justifiable fear. And Pompey, Pompey has no desires now or at any time in his career to be the unlawful ruler or tyrant of Rome. And his troops pull him back out onto the platform, and Pompey says that he would rather kill himself than march illegally on Rome with his troops. And if they keep pressing the issue, he is going to kill himself.
Right. And so I think it's really interesting too, to kind of, think about this period. You know, he installs as the governor of Sicily, he installs Mimius, which was, basically a brother-in-law.
Yeah.
And Mimius was a part of the Metellus family, and now, by reinstalling the people who he installed in Africa, Hyempsal, he's basically installing clientelia in Africa, and these are the main overseas grain supplies for Rome. And you can see time and time again, whenever this overseas grain supply starts getting tampered with in any way, people start freaking out in Rome in a major way. So this is right now, even as young as he is, Pompey is in a power position because basically he owns all the food supply to Rome. So if Pompey wanted to take over Rome, he could just cut off all supply of grain from Sicily and Africa. And perhaps later on we'll see him, thinking about this with his war with Caesar, basically, at this point, he could cut off, if he really wanted to, Polisola, he could cut off the grain supply, weaken the forces of Sulla and proceed to march on Rome. But being as young as he is and so ensconced in the Metelli family, he really doesn't have any reason to, because he is now at one of the top positions in the Roman army anyway, and there's really very little reason for him to really march on Rome and defy Sulla.
So he probably doesn't deserve the title of the kid, the famous title of the kid butcher. And he's also called Sulla's pupil by his eventual enemy Sertorius, which perhaps, after all, is not, I deserve a title. At any rate, Pompey does return to Rome.
I think what's another interesting story that really illustrates that he probably didn't deserve the title of the boy butcher, Juvenatus Adolescens, I believe it is, is the story that we're told about his interaction with a man named Cethegus. Basically, he goes to a town that was accused of housing Marius when Marius was fleeing.
That's the one, yeah.
Basically, he is about to destroy the entire town, punish the entire town for having housed the enemy. There's a man that comes in and says, I know who is the culprit. I know who did this. He says it was me. Cethegus did it, or Cethegus did it. And Pompey is so impressed with this that he spares the town and spares the man. And we're also told that, while he was taking Carbo and putting him in chains, he was also allowing a lot of the Marian officers to escape kind of out the back door. So we kind of get this overtone that he was kind of imposing this strict example on Carbo for Sulla, but in reality he was attempting to spare as many Romans as he could.
Oh, I agree. Pompey returns, and this is where he is named Magnus. But Pompey to Sulla demands an African triumph. Sulla naturally refuses. Sulla is a staunch constitutionalist, and moreover, he reforms the constitution, so he's really not running the budge here. For triumphs are only reserved for consuls and praetorian, or people of consular and praetorian rank. And supposedly, according to some ancient sources, after Sulla famously shoots Pompey down, Pompey famously remarks that Sulla should reflect that more men worship the rising sun than the setting sun. And Sulla apparently doesn't hear this, and he demands to know what is said, and somebody tells him, and he famously says, let the man triumph. So Pompey is granted his first triumph. He is still a member of the equestrian class, and he probably does have an opportunity to at least enter the Senate here now, and either because he likes that he's been given these extraordinary commands, or he likes to kind of pride himself on his, his humble origins, though he was probably a really wealthy man, even as a child. He is the first and last knight to triumph through Rome. And some of those elephants that he apparently caged on his safari, he tries to lead his chariot in the triumphal procession, but the elephants won't fit through the gateways of the city, so he embarrassingly has to stick with the traditional four horses. And another, I'm sure you have some things to add about the triumphal perception of the triumph, but another really popular story is that his troops suddenly, and these troops are giving him all sorts of hell, but the troops suddenly demand more pay from Pompey. He's already stood up to Sulla, so they think, we're not going to triumph unless we get more money, and they start demanding more, which is pretty ungrateful. And they would rather, and Pompey tells them, look, I would rather just skip this triumph and punish you all then to go through. So Pompey does not give in to their demands. And by the end of the day, Pompey ends up winning a lot of admiration, even from some of the popular, senators who aren't necessarily sympathizers of him. Members among the aristocracy respect the way he deals with his troops. And the ones who were just kind of favoring him end up respecting him even more.
And I think what a big deal a triumph is, it is really, it is really important to understand basically how these families worked in Rome. there was a myth that anyone could become, you could basically choose your own destiny if you worked hard enough in Rome. Obviously this wasn't the case, you know, in a city of maybe a half, a quarter million, people, there were 300 senators in any given time. And there was only really 27, I think around 27 royal or affluent aristocratic families, in Rome. But basically, you had to work your way up in the military. And then you had to achieve some kind of great victory in the name of Rome and expand Rome, and really bring honor to Rome. And then you were able to march in a triumph, and very few people ever got a triumph ever. But basically once you had a triumph, it brought recognition to your family. It brought prestige. It brought, the greatest, the honor of the Senate and the honor of the people. And it projected your family into, a hall of great names, you know, or into a record of great names of Rome. And it established you and your family, amongst the great families of Rome.
And every Roman boy was brought up to believe that they need to not only honor their ancestors, but they need to do as well as they do or better. So there's a lot of family pride here. And Plutarch maintains that Pompey could have easily become a senator at this point, but instead he chose to gleam in his humble origins, which is kind of a romantic story that we see with Marius. But I'm a little suspicious of this. Because it's very interesting. That's very interesting. But Sulla's constitutional reforms, which we will discuss, he does set very specific and strict age limits on who can hold office and the duration in between the offices. And there was in the histories I read of a man named Quintus Lucretius Ofella. He had petitioned his desire to run for the consulship, though he wasn't of consular age. He was actually a favorite of Sulla, and he had served with Sulla in the civil wars. Sulla had politely asked him not to canvass for office. Ofella, of course, refused, and Sulla later had him assassinated in the Forum. So even though we have this romantic story of Plutarch saying that Pompey wanted to maintain his humble origins, it's doubtless that Pompey probably watched all this with considerable mindfulness. Yes, he had defied Sulla in the past, but he was pretty wary of where he can push his limits or not, because at this point, Sulla was the absolute master of the world, and I just wanted to add that little antidote there.
Right, and I think he was an absolute master of the world. I would add, with the exception, I would say, of the Metelli family. I think Sulla had married into the Metelli family. Metellius Pius, was probably one of the most powerful man in Rome, right behind Sulla at this point in time.
Yeah. Well, the Metelli seem to be the ones who benefited most from, Sulla's reforms. And at the very least, it would protect their lineage. And what's really awesome about Sulla's reforms, which on paper seemed to be pretty legitimate ones, was that he most importantly set out to protect the Republic from people like Pompey, from these extraordinary commands, to protect the Republic from people who do things like what Marius himself did and Sulla did and Marius did before him.
Right, and I think what's really interesting is possibly one of the reasons why Sulla kind of allowed Pompey to triumph, even though he was not of the proper age, which would be, if we look at Sulla's reforms, completely out of line with his values. I think one of the reasons why he allowed this to happen is because Sulla was now married into the same family that he was married into, which is the Metelli family. So there was kind of a implicit understanding that, honor would be brought to Pompey, which would bring honor to the Metelli, which would bring honor to himself. and more legitimacy to himself. It was also, I think, almost a stamp on the end of the Civil War, to kind of, stamp it, even though the Civil War was not actually over. Sulla was now the dictator of Rome. You know, we still have Sertorius in Spain, you know, Perperna, who escaped, with Carbo to the Sicily in Africa, was now making his way to Sertorius. A lot of the officers that escaped had been making their way to Sertorius. And Sertorius was really setting up another doppelganger cities of that was kind of like Rome. He was setting up his own kind of faux Roman republic.
With a Senate schools for the aristocrats, the sons of the aristocrats.
Which we'll get into in later episodes, but really we'll start to see in our next few episodes we'll be getting into Sulla's reforms. We'll be getting into the Lepidus affair, and really when we start to see Sulla and Pompey escalate in their tensions. And then we will see, more, political dealings with, within the Metelli family, and these political court systems really start to become really important as we move forward in this story. Also we'll go into Pompey and Metellius Pius in Spain, and the wars in Spain against Sertorius.
Did we mention the marriage alliance with Mucia?
Mucia? Yeah. I don't think we have. But, you know, around the time of the trial of sex, you know, Pompey ends up getting married again, this time to Mucia, who's actually the half-sister of Celer Metellius and Nepos Metellius, who also become very important figures in this story. And really, this new marriage alliance with a different lady, it ends up becoming the longest marriage of Pompey, and really the only marriage in which they even have Pompey even has children.
Three children, I believe. Pompeia, Gnaeus. It was pretty traditional to name your firstborn son after you. So she gives birth to Pompeia, Gnaeus Pompeius, and Sextus Pompey. After Pompey's triumph, he's easily the most distinguished knight in Rome, probably the whole history of Rome. And it's worth reiterating that Pompey's family was no help to him politically, more or less. Though his sister married C. Mimius, but his uncle Sextus was a philosopher and jurist who avoided politics by all accounts, and his mother's brother Lucius Pompeius was content with running the family estates.
Right. So basically, at this point, he is one of the foremost military figures in Rome, probably right underneath Metellus Pius and Sulla.
Do you want to go into, I've only got a couple pages here on Sulla's reforms. Do you want to end it with that?
No, I think we should start with those next time.
So the next time we're going to do Sulla's reforms, the Lepidus affair, and Sertorius?
Yeah.
You sure you don't want to go through the reforms?
Okay, if you don't mind doing the brunt of them. I mean, I can jump in here and there, but.
Okay. This was kind of a hard episode. It's not a very well, it's a relatively poorly documented time in Republican history. The condition of Rome after Pompey's triumph, we find that both consuls, of course, were dead. So an interrex was chosen until Sulla was properly named dictator. This interrex, which was a position chosen by the Senate, was basically a temporary consul that only served for, I think, a day at a time. So an interrex would be chosen if the Republic ever fell into a time where no consuls were actively serving the state. He has one of these interrexes, who's a friend of Sulla's, proposed to make Sulla dictator of Rome. This post of the dictator, which was only supposed to be used traditionally in times of great emergency, basically had the power of both consuls, but was also reminiscent of the ancient power of the kings. That is the power of life and death. This post, however, had fallen into complete obscurity and had not been used since 202 BC. But it wouldn't be enough. So Lucius Valerius Flaccus, who was the interrex who proposed to make Sulla dictator, he proposed to extend his dictatorship so that he can reconcile the Republic and its constitution. So, as dictator for an extended stay, Sulla busied himself with reforming the Roman constitution. Ben, okay. Go ahead.
So basically, Sulla, he at this point, as dictator, he sought to strengthen the aristocracy and thus strengthen the Senate, which has lots of implications for, you know, the Metelli family, which are is a preeminent family at this point. Sulla retained his earlier reforms that he made before he left for his Mithridatic campaigns. This includes the provision which required the Senate approval before any bill could be submitted to the plebeian council, which we talked about in an earlier episode.
And also that the laws could not be brought to the people to handpick generals. That was another big thing. He wanted to give the control of selecting generals for overseas campaigns back to the Senate.
Right. And he also, restored a lot of those powers to the centuriata and the centuriate assembly, and really installed these, land owning individuals. And that kind of went back to the Servian reforms of the 400 BC era, in which, you were basically funneled into a hierarchy of a class system in which you had to own land in order to have any say, which at this point, and in this kind of military makeup, is obviously kind of a recipe for disaster, I think. But, I think at this point, Sulla was really making some really insightful moves, but I don't know if he really would, have had the entire foresight that we have, with our modern libraries and books and knowledge and political history that we can pull from. But really, if we really look at what was going on up until the 3rd century BC, the plebeian council was really legally required to obtain senatorial authorization before enacting any laws, while the centuriate assembly was organized in such a manner that the aristocratic class could deny the lower classes any political power.
But some of his reforms almost seem as if he did. I'll point out some of the things I thought were short-sighted, but some of the reforms he did seems like he was reading, like he got a copy of Cassius Dio himself and was making reforms to at least had a semblance of restoring things back to the traditional ways. One thing was diminishing the power of the tribunes. They no longer had a veto within the Senate, could no longer pass laws. Well, actually, more importantly, he made the tribunate a dead end political career. If you serve as a tribune, you cannot proceed to higher and higher offices. He redefined the laws regarding treason, which he redefined to prevent what Sulla was doing and Marius and Strabo had done, and it basically revolved around armies being loyal to their generals. And he also placed the courts back under the control of the Senate. He changed the age limit of the offices and required 10 years between consulships. So none of this 6-year consecutive consulships that we saw with the extraordinary career of Marius.
Sulla then, he went after and he sought about, as part of his reforms, to weaken some of the magistrate offices in Rome. And he did this by basically increasing the number of magistrates that were going to be elected in any given year. And he also required that all newly elected quaestors be given automatic membership in the Senate.
The other half of the Senate that he added to, he selected a large of these people from the body of the knights. And I think that if you remember from the introduction episodes we recorded, the Knights started to realize that they had separate interests from the Senate, and so they became a political force to reckon with, especially if they allied themselves with the Populares. By theoretically adding Knights to the senatorial body, he would ally the senatorial interests with the Knights and take out that political liability. But he was also a little short-sighted, and Sulla doesn't seem to have provided any means to pay the soldiers for their service to the state. And that seems to be one of just the hugest things that toppled the Republic. So as far as not having a library in front of him and the foresight and all that, not providing some way to keep soldiers loyal to the Republic seems to be pretty short-sighted.
At this point, Sulla transferred the control of the courts from the Knights, these equites who had been gradually waging this combat in the court system. You know, we had talked about in a previous episode the trial of Scaevola's legate, Rutilius, which was a direct attack, basically a show trial on the Senate. So he basically restored all the court system to the senators. And he also increased the number of courts, which further added to the power that was already held by the senators. And I believe you talked about this briefly, but he codified and established definitively the cursus honorum, which required an individual to reach a certain age and level of experience before running for any particular before any particular office. In the past, the cursus honorum had been observed through precedent, but it had never really been codified. And by requiring senators to be more experienced than they had in the past, he hoped to add to the prestige and thus the authority of the Senate. You know, basically, Sulla was taking the Roman system back to what it was before the Gracchi came in and started their populist movement, which was then subverted by a number of different political players, and the equites began dominating the court system.
He wanted to undo these terminal precedents that we've been constantly been discussing. How effective they were, we'll see. That they don't last very long after the dictator's death. But just like you said, he wants to undo some of these dangerous precedents that we've been discussing for the last, you know, 3 or 4 episodes.
Right.
All right, so that's about all the time we have for this week. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, don't hesitate to email us at lifeofpompey@gmail.com. And our website should be up and operational, where you could also find a archive of all of our current podcasts. That website is, Luke?
lifeofpompey.wordpress.com.
Yeah, don't forget it. Yeah, go ahead and email us your suggestions, comments. Ream me for my terrible pronunciations of African kings today. That's fine. Thank you for tuning in. We do appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have another episode posted next week. And we're going to be moving on with the war with Sertorius in Spain. Thank you for listening to Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic.
Thank you.